Welcome to episode 2 of Don't Talk to Strangers, a long look inside a series of child murders that took place in the Metro Detroit area between January 1976 and March 1977. Because we are discussing the murder and sexual assault of children, this content may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. If you're over the age of 30 and grew up in the Detroit area, you're familiar with this case. You've likely heard of the Oakland County child killer. You probably sat through stranger danger videos offered in a darkened classroom via projector or VCR recording. Or a uniformed officer came to your school for an assembly. "Hey kids, don't hitchhike. Don't go with strangers. Nay, nay, stranger, stay away." Growing up in the Detroit area, particularly in South Oakland County, along the Woodward Avenue corridor, this case was there, lingering, lurking. These murders influenced your childhood, and they likely influence the way you parent your own children today. There are unanswered questions, misinformation, and secrecy surrounding the case. 9 murdered children in 15 months. Only 3 of the cases are closed. The other 6 are open and unsolved. Tragic, mysterious, and frustrating. Over the next several weeks, we will be looking at each murder, reviewing how the cases intersect and which cases are resolved while others are still open, still waiting, still sitting in a dusty file cabinet hoping for an elusive DNA match or a confession. In episode 1, we covered what was known, at least briefly, as the babysitter murders, the deaths of 3 teenage girls, 16-year-old Judy Farrow of Redford Township, 16-year-old Cynthia Cadieu of Roseville, and 14-year-old Sheila Strock of Birmingham. All 3 of these cases would eventually be solved, with 2 of them leading to prosecution. Gary Pervinkler, alleged killer of Judy Farrow, died prior to being apprehended. In the mid to late 1970s, my mom or my grandmother took me to Ferndale at least once a week. It was a good place to shop, because Ferndale had the big F&M store right on 9 Mile. F&M was a discount health and beauty store, and I remember slipping my legs into the seat at the top of the cart while mom or grandma guided the buggy up and down the aisles, looking at cosmetics, shampoo, aspirin, and whatnot. F&M was one of the first bargain drugstore chains in the United States, owned by the Cohen family. They sold brand-name products at discount prices, and people, including my family, flocked to the 9,000-square-foot store for their health and beauty needs. Back then, there were parking spaces along 9 Mile Road, but we usually parked behind the store, or, if there was more shopping to do, the boulevard on Woodward had a parking lot, and we'd leave the car there and walk to our destination. F&M and that boulevard lot on Woodward Avenue are long gone, but in 1976 and today, Ferndale is a walkable community, and 9 Mile is dotted with shops and restaurants. Steps away from 9 Mile Road are row after row of neighborhoods with family homes, modest homes, like the story-and-a-half bungalow where 12-year-old Mark Stebbins lived with his 39-year-old mother, Ruth, and his older brother, Mike. The city of Ferndale is on the southern edge of Oakland County and shares a border with the city of Detroit. Sunday, February 15th, 1976, was an unseasonably warm day in Detroit. Mid-February usually calls for temperatures in the 20s, but it was almost 50 degrees. And while the sun wasn't shining, the warmth was a welcome reprieve from the usual snow and cold of a Michigan winter. The Stebbins family, Mom Ruth, and her boys, Mike and Mark, had plans that afternoon. Ruth's work was throwing a party at the American Legion Hall off 9 Mile Road, just 3 blocks west of the previously mentioned F&M store. There was food, socializing, and the hall's many pool tables were busy, with a billiard tournament in progress. The party wasn't really Mark's speed, and around noon he asked his mom if he could have money to go to the local hobby shop. Ruth said no, but Mark didn't seem upset by her saying no. A few minutes later, he told her he was going to walk home, maybe watch some television. It was 12:25 p.m. when she told Mark to be careful walking home and bid him farewell. It would be the last time she saw her son alive. The walk from the American Legion Hall to the Stebbins' home on East Saratoga was almost a mile. He would have to walk east, passing the F&M store as he made his way toward Woodward Avenue, then cross the busy 8-lane boulevard and head 2 blocks south to his street. This was likely a walk Mark had made many times before. He was dressed in jeans, black rubber boots, and a hooded jacket. It was mid-February, but the unseasonably warm weather made for a nice walk. If you saw him, a slender boy, just under 5 feet tall, with reddish-blonde hair and blue eyes, you wouldn't have given him a second thought. Mark was an ordinary kid, walking home on an ordinary Sunday afternoon. In 1976, cell phones aren't a thing. You would use a payphone if you wanted to make a call. Ruth did use a payphone at the American Legion Hall to call home in the late afternoon, wanting to check in with Mark, but she received no answer. This didn't concern her. She figured that he'd headed out to visit a friend or to ride his bike. She didn't know that Mark hadn't made it back to their house at all. When Ruth Stebbins returns home that evening, it's nearly 9 p.m., and Mark isn't there. She checks with her older son, Mike, and he hasn't seen him either. The first stirrings of worry started, a low tremble in her chest. Ruth shook her head and decided she'd give him a bit longer. Kids do lose track of time. Looking outside at the deep darkness of a February night, I wonder if she knew that Mark was gone and he wouldn't be coming back. It was 10 p.m. when Ruth picked up the phone and called the Ferndale police. The officer who took the call was likely trying to reassure her when, according to a blog post, he said, quote, "We haven't had a kidnapping in 10 years." Ruth was not reassured. The officer suggested that Mark had run away or was staying with friends. But Ruth had called her neighbors, she'd called the homes of Mark's friends, and no one had seen her son. When Ruth climbed into bed, she was alone with her fears. She'd been a single woman since splitting from her husband, Lester, the boy's father, back in 1969. Her boys were close and looked out for each other, and she did her best to provide for them with little help from her former husband. Ruth Stebbins lay in bed on her back, staring at the ceiling. Every noise, every sound she heard, she tensed and focused. Was it Mark? Had he made it home? When she finally got out of bed, far earlier than usual, she checked Mark's room, just in case. But the narrow bed was empty, cold. There was no sign of her youngest child. On Monday morning, she sent 15-year-old Mikey to school and headed to the police station. Sunday night, the police told her he'd turn up, but he hadn't. He was 12, still a child, and they needed to look for him. Mark was a good boy. Both Mark and Mike were good boys. They didn't give her any trouble. This time, the police listened to her, decided that his disappearance was serious, not just a runaway child, and a search was organized. All of Mark's school friends were contacted, but not one of them had seen him. Police performed a canvas of the area between the American Legion Hall and the Stebbins' home on East Saratoga. Ruth could not let her mind think that the worst had happened. That night, when she prepared her evening meal, she sat 3 places at the dinner table, and she and Mikey sat at the table together, the unused setting between them, a question on both of their minds, but unspoken. The dinner routine was repeated the next night, 3 places at the table, for Ruth, Mike, and Mark, but only Ruth and Mike were there for the meal, for food they didn't really eat, just pushed around the plate. Mark was gone, but they were joined at the table by fear and anxiety. Each day he was missing led them closer to an answer neither one of them wanted to hear. Thursday, February 19th, was another mild day in Detroit. Temps were again in the 40s, and a man by the name of Mark Bodegeimer of Southfield is headed to the office. He works in a small building in Southfield on 10 Mile Road, just 4 miles west of the American Legion Hall where Mark was last seen. As he pulled into the parking lot just after 10 a.m., he comes across a bizarre scene. A boy appears to be sleeping in a weedy corner of the lot near the dumpster. Taking a closer look, Bodegeimer realizes that the child is not asleep, and he races into the office, grabbing the phone to call police. 12-year-old Mark Stebbins is no longer missing. Bodegeimer and his coworkers return to the lot to look after Mark's body and wait for police to arrive. Mark is on his side, the hood of his jacket pulled up over his head, concealing wounds on his scalp. A blanket is covering him. It's not clear if someone from the office covered Mark with the blanket or if the killer covered him with a blanket after laying him on the ground in the parking lot. This blanket will present problems for investigators going forward, but we'll get back to that. When police canvass the area, they learn that a man was out walking his dog and went through the lot around 9:30 a.m. He did not notice the body of a child in the lot as he passed by. The man told police he was certain that his dog would have reacted to the body had it been there. The discovery of Mark Stebbins in Southfield marks the first jurisdictional conflict of the four confirmed victims of the Oakland County child killer. It will not be the last. Children being picked up in one jurisdiction and dumped days later in another city or county is a hallmark of this case. That third week of February, Ferndale has the missing persons investigation and Southfield has the murder. If you believe what you read online, Southfield mishandled Mark's remains. Blog posts suggest that Mark's body was removed from the weedy parking lot on 10 Mile Road and taken from the site to the Southfield Police Department, not to the Oakland County Medical Examiner's Office off Telegraph Road in Pontiac. Moving the body before it was processed makes it difficult for lab technicians to do their job. Terms like contamination get thrown around. Evidence that won't hold up in court. Not that this case is ever going to trial. When the Michigan State Police examined the area where Mark's body was left, they didn't find much of interest. Dirt, rodent hair, fibers consistent with the blanket he'd been covered with, more fibers that match samples taken from his home and from the American Legion Hall he'd been with his family at on Sunday. His blue hooded jacket showed normal wear and tear, except for the bloodstains in the hood area, likely from his head wound. While the cause of death was not immediately released, there are whispers of strangulation, rope burns, and ligature marks on Mark's neck and wrists. When his small body arrived at the medical examiner's office, an autopsy was scheduled for first thing Friday morning. Also, let's dispel the washed and sanitized rumor right here. Many people believe that the four victims of the Oakland County child killer were scrubbed down with their clothing laundered and pressed before they were left neatly on the side of the road. Mark Stebbins was not washed clean while he was held. His clothing, particularly his socks, t-shirt, and underpants, were not clean. I will read to you directly from the Michigan State Police lab report where his clothes were analyzed. Item 11, underpants. The condition of the underpants is consistent with their having been worn for a relatively extended period of time. No semen was found. Item 12, t-shirt. The t-shirt is soiled and suggests considerable wear since washing. Both the stained and soiled appearance and the presence of perspiration odor support this contention. Bloodstains are present. Now, there's no clarification as to the location or amount of blood on the shirt. I assume that the bloodstains came from the wound on Mark's head. Moving on to the autopsy, there are issues with the Oakland County Medical Examiner's Office. And we will cover this in a later episode because the situation at the ME's office was, to put it mildly, problematic. However, the autopsy of Mark Stebbins was handled by Dr. Thomas J. Patinga, the associate medical examiner. Patinga did a thorough workup collecting blood and tissue samples that he has sent out for further examination. He notes that in addition to marks on Stebbins' wrist and neck, suggesting strangulation and confinement, there are also marks on his ankles. Someone tied up and restrained Mark Stebbins during the time that he was gone. Mark also suffered a blow to the back of the head. His scalp was cut, but his clothing was not bloodstained, except for the undershirt and the jacket. There are two theories about this injury. It could have been made with the barrel of a shotgun, which will tie into a later murder, or Mark's head was injured by a trunk lock when his body was placed or forced into the back of a vehicle. His body showed signs of bruising and sexual assault, but there were no biological materials left behind. For those of you wondering about organic materials left by the killer, such as saliva or semen, it does not appear that there was anything recovered. The evidence found on Mark Stebbins, using the finest investigative techniques available in 1976, consisted of synthetic carpet fibers and animal hair, possibly from a dog. The lab report on Mark Stebbins' body is an interesting read, with 13 items listed, but item number 9 is redacted. There's an addendum at the end of the report, quote, "It is unfortunate that the dirt and debris samples from the parking lot and the blanket used to cover the body were not made available to the laboratory until May of 1977. It would have been particularly useful to know that a dirty blanket had been used to cover the body and that this blanket is the probable source of trace evidence present on the clothing." Not made available to the lab until May of 77? Why did it take more than a year for these items to get to the lab? Where was the blanket in the meantime? What evidence in the Stebbins case was lost or mishandled? It's a very frustrating footnote, and we don't have a lot of answers. A person or persons held Mark Stebbins captive for 5 days, and during that time he was abused, sexually assaulted, and restrained. His cause of death is thought to be smothering, either from an object being placed over his face, such as a pillow, or someone clamping a hand across his mouth while pinching his nose closed, cutting off the airway until he was dead. Once he was dead, the killer placed his body in the parking lot of a small office complex just 5 miles from where he was last seen in Ferndale. Investigators returned to the location where his body was discovered. When employees are questioned, one admits to seeing a vehicle near the dumpster in the parking lot that morning. When pressed for details, the best they can offer is that it's a Buick, or maybe a Pontiac. If the witnesses suggested a color for the vehicle, that information isn't made public. The car is described as shiny and small, which, in 1976, narrows things down. In the mid-1970s, Americans are driving large, roomy vehicles. Smaller cars are on their way in, but a small vehicle with a General Motors badge, which is what the witness said they saw, this narrows the list of options. Make a mental note of the car, because we're going to talk about it again in a moment. On Sunday, February 22nd, 1 week to the day from when Mark disappeared, more than 40 police officers take to the streets of Ferndale, retracing the route Mark would have taken home. They speak to hundreds of people, hoping that someone saw who the fair-haired 12-year-old walked away with. Ferndale Police Chief Donald Geary tells the press that the department is sifting through, quote, piles of tips in the case. While Ruth and Mike plan a funeral for Mark, the reserved 12-year-old boy who'd spoken of someday joining the Marines, Ferndale Police get to work. They canvass the area along 9 Mile Road, speaking to residents, employees, pedestrians, anyone who may have seen Mark that day. Because there was no photograph of him in the clothes he was wearing, a sketch artist created an image for police to show potential witnesses, along with Mark's class photo from school. Everyone wanted to help, which led to a great deal of information coming in, tips from the community, but not all of it is relevant or accurate. There is another sketch related to this case, located in the bedroom of a suspect, but we will discuss this second sketch in a future episode. Mark's father, Lester Stebbins, flew in from Houston, Texas for the funeral, and not long after he arrives, police arrest him for failure to pay child support to Ruth Stebbins over the last several years. Oakland County Prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson arranges for Stebbins' release on bond, allowing him to attend the funeral of his son. Patterson also allows him to return to Texas with the understanding that he will need to resume making child support payments and begin paying back what he owed for the many months where he sent no money to support his two children. The funeral service for Mark Stebbins is held on Monday, February 23rd, 1976, at the St. James Catholic Church on Woodward Avenue in Ferndale. St. James is a beautiful cathedral-style church with soaring ceilings and white marble floors. Ruth Stebbins was not in a position to pay for her son's funeral, and the Ferndale JCs generously stepped in with funds to cover expenses. During the service, the St. James Choir performed, and Ruth Stebbins complimented them on their selections, saying, quote, There wasn't a dry eye in the house when they sang The Impossible Dream at the end of the service. Mark Stebbins is laid to rest at the Christian Memorial Cemetery in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Days after Mark was buried, a strange discovery is made at the location where his body was found. Someone left a prayer card from his memorial service on the same spot where his body was left. Could the killer or killers have attended the service, taken a card, and left it behind where his body was dumped? The thought was distressing to Ruth. There were so many people who came to pay their respects. Could she have shaken hands with or accepted condolences from the person who killed her child? Losing Mark was the hardest thing that Ruth ever endured, but her battles were not over. 15-year-old Mike was not coping well with the brutal murder of his kid brother. Both her boys were responsible, respectful kids, but once Mark was gone, something changed in her oldest son. He began drinking and using drugs. There were fights and brushes with law enforcement. Ruth despaired. It was as if both of her sons were lost, crippled by grief and anxiety. She was unable to work and lost her job, relying on handouts to get by. It would be several years before Ruth Stebbins was well enough to resume a life similar to the one she had before February of 1976. Mike, her surviving son, did pull himself together, and now, as a man of nearly 60 years old, he recognizes that grief and anger drove him to make poor choices and engage in self-destructive behaviors. During an interview a few years ago, he told the press, quote, "Mark's gone, Mom's gone, I'm all alone now." Whatever monster took Mark Stebbins, he created a wound in the lives of those that loved him, a wound that still festers 5 decades later. The murder of Mark Stebbins spurred people to send in tips. People were upset about the death of another child, and the trio of violent murders in January were still fresh in the community consciousness. One of the tips that came in involved two names, Gregory Green and Christopher Bush. And we're going to hear a lot about these two in future episodes. Gregory Green was originally from the Detroit area. His family, a mother, father, and 3 siblings, moved to Flint in the mid-1950s when he was 5 years old. His family was not close, and his mother died when he was 16 years old. Losing his mother at this age did not help him feel loved or secure as he became an adult. Green turned his negative feelings outwards, pursuing sexual contact with children, primarily young boys. At the age of 20, he moved to California. In addition to holding a janitorial position at a local department store, Green coached youth baseball, allowing him access to a variety of children. While living in the Huntington Beach area, he molested several boys aged 10 to 14. In his book, The Kill Jar, author J. Reuben Appleman details a disturbing event from Green's past, an incident that occurred in California where Green took one of the boys from his Little League team into the woods to assault. When the boy resisted Green's advances, Green beat him, then pressed a hand over his mouth, holding it there, cutting off his oxygen until the boy was still. Green thought that maybe the kid was dead, and he lit a cigarette thinking about what he should do next. After taking a few drags, he pressed the lit cigarette into the boy's stomach looking for a response. There was none, so he repeated the action, burning him again. The boy wasn't dead, but the burns did not cause him to wake up. Green hauled the unresponsive child to his car and dumped the body on the side of the road near a hospital. The injured boy was found, rushed to the emergency room, and he would make a full recovery. Green would be picked up by police and admitted to what he did. He also confessed to molesting literally dozens of other children. The legal system in California sent him off to the Patton State Mental Hospital, a 1,500-bed facility in San Bernardino. Green would reside there for a year receiving treatment. Let that sink in. Gregory Green nearly killed a boy, and he admitted to molesting dozens of other children. But after a year in a psychiatric hospital, he is released and allowed to return to Michigan, to return to his family in 1975. When he returns to Michigan, he makes a new friend, Christopher Bush. I've read conflicting reports on how Green and Bush got acquainted. There is speculation that the two are somehow related, perhaps through the family of Bush's sister-in-law, as Bush's brother and the Green family were residing in Flint in the mid-1970s. When Mark Stebbins' body was left at the Southfield office complex on 10 Mile Road, a witness mentioned seeing a shiny Buick or Pontiac in the parking lot near where Mark's body was left. The car was there for, quote, several minutes. Christopher Bush, whose father was an executive at General Motors, drove a blue Chevy Vega. The body style was identical to that of the Pontiac Aster and the Buick Skyhawk. It's possible that the vehicle spotted in the parking lot that morning wasn't a Buick or a Pontiac, but a cousin from the Chevrolet side of the General Motors family. Perhaps even a blue Vega. I recently visited the location where Mark's body was recovered that cold February day. The parking lot of the office building is small, and it's just west of an equally small shopping plaza. The office building and shopping plaza are close to 10 Mile Road. They're physically close to the street. And it seems like a strange location to leave a body. Very public and open. Behind the office and shopping center are a row of homes, making it difficult to pull in and drive around to the back of the center. If you decide to go to that location yourself or bring it up on Google Maps, the building has changed in the 40 years since Mark was left. I also believe that the road, 10 Mile, was widened from 2 lanes to 4 lanes. Looking at the space now, it's not like it was in 1976. If you investigate this location further, you may notice that it is just down the road from a Michigan State Police post. And it is my understanding from conversations with members of the Michigan State Police that this post in Oak Park, it didn't open until the late 1980s. The opening of the post coincided with the opening of the center section of Interstate 696. If I were looking for a place to leave a body, this is not the location I would have selected. It's exposed, with buildings on either side and a busy road just a few feet away. Mark was abandoned there so he would be found, so his body would be noticed and recovered. When Gregory Green thought he'd killed that boy in California, he left him on the side of the road in a public, visible spot. The similarities are hard to ignore. As February ends and March begins, Southfield and Ferndale police continue to receive tips and follow up on leads, but there are no arrests made. No person of interest is named. A $5,000 reward is posted for information leading to an arrest in the case. The Ferndale City Council, the South Oakland Law Enforcement Union, and private citizens contribute to the fund. Oakland County Prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson attends an assembly at Lincoln Middle School in Ferndale. Lincoln was the school that Mark attended. Patterson addresses Mark's classmates and asks them to assist in raising money to find out what happened to their friend. Patterson tells the assembled children that he will match any funds they raise. Patterson tells them, quote, "My job as prosecutor is to convict the killer, but I can't do it by myself. I need the help of citizens like yourselves." Patterson, as county prosecutor, will be a fixture in this story. We're going to be hearing a lot from him in the weeks ahead. In the last week of February, we are barely 2 months into the new year and have 4 dead children to show for it: Judy, Cynthia, Sheila, and Mark. Press coverage of Mark's case goes quiet, and the community, with the exception of the Stebbins family, returns to normal. After 4 dead children in the first 2 months of the year, the community will enjoy a 6-month reprieve from the Oakland County child murders. This gives the residents of South Oakland County time to celebrate the bicentennial, maybe take a drive out to Belle Isle, or spend a long weekend up north without hearing of yet another missing or murdered kid. No one has ever been arrested or charged with the murder of Mark Stebbins. This season of Don't Talk to Strangers focuses on the 9 child murders that took place in the Metro Detroit area between January 1, 1976 and March of 1977. For more information about the case, to read some of our research, see pictures of the players and locations discussed here, please visit our website, www.dttspodcast.com. That's dttspodcast.com. I'm Nina Instead, the writer, producer, and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. Our content editor is Joni Hubrid. Research assistance provided by Grace Kaleza.
Get mad when listening to true crime? Well, so do I. If you want a weekly true crime podcast that says what you're thinking, then grab a beer and pull up a deck chair. This is Cambo from True Crime Island, another true crime podcast, and maintain the rage with me. Visit truecrimeisland.com where you can download or stream each episode. Plus, there's links to iTunes and social media. And as I always say, don't forget to delete your browser history. This is True Crime Island.